Finding a Place for Engineering and Science Publications, Alan Brown.
First, I'd like to thank Alejandra Leon and Red Pop for inviting me, Estrella Barros for being my interpreter, and everyone else who's shown me such enormous kindness and hospitality. I'm quite taken by Costa Rica and your vibrant Latin culture, and I hope to return in a few years and be able to give a talk in Spanish. Mal español, pero breve. Meanwhile, I must warn you, I'm from New York. I sometimes talk fast. If I start talking too fast, please raise your hand and I will try to slow myself down. Today, I'm here to talk about why engineering is important, how it differs from science, and maybe tell some stories about how engineers do their work so you can get a flavor of the process. And if we have any time, maybe some discussion of questions journalists could ask engineers to get at the heart of the story. As science writers, as people who operate museums, we tend to focus on discovery. Often, we wind up treating engineering as if it's unimportant, almost trivial. Yet engineers are the people who created the things in our world. They're the ones who deliver scientific advances in terms of things that are practical and that we can get our hands on. If you look at the big problems in the world, things like global warming, sustainable energy, population growth, economic development, it is engineers who are going to be able to design the cars that don't pollute, build more efficient wind turbines, and perhaps create factories that lift the standard of living not only for their owners, but for the people who work in them. I'll tell you a little story. The other day I was wandering at night down in downtown here at San Jose, and I noticed somebody had spread out some inexpensive little metal cars, you know, the type you wind up for children and they zip along. And I said to myself, well, I wonder where they came from. Maybe Taiwan, maybe Brazil, maybe Japan. But I remember when I was young, all those cars came from Japan, rather. Not China, not Brazil, not a nation we think of as a developing country, but a nation we think of at the very top of the technology ladder, Japan. And Japan's emphasis on engineering is what changed Japan from a country that made cheap things into a country that makes great technology. Back in the 1970s, when people were realizing that Japanese cars lasted longer than their American cars in my country, people and corporations would say, well, the Japanese do no scientific research. And they didn't. They did great engineering, and they kept doing it, and it turned Tokyo from that to that. As science communicators, we have a special responsibility. When we write about discovery, we often don't cover what it takes to make that discovery practical. And that's what I'd like to do. Engineering is often treated as some trivial task. You know, great breakthrough, we can now make non-polluting motors. But no one bothers to talk about the real effort it takes to take those non-polluting motors, those ideas, and make them something that every man and woman can afford to buy. Engineering is not trivial. Think of the time it took. We knew about rockets hundreds of years ago, perhaps 1,000 years ago. We only were using them to actually do something fairly recently. Fuel cells were invented 170 years ago, and last week I just finished a story about what might be the first practical fuel cell use in transportation. Nuclear fusion, we know the science behind it, but we don't understand how to make it practical. Engineering takes time. And one of the things that happens very often, because it takes time and we don't report to our readers and the people who come to our museums that it takes time, is that people want those discoveries now, and they become disillusioned with science when they don't get them. So what I'd like to talk a little bit now is, what is engineering? And there are plenty of definitions. So here's one. Engineering is applying scientific principles to the design and creation of man-made objects. Now, there are many types of engineering, from mechanical, civil, electrical, electronic, optical, chemical. engineering might include very simple designs, a mortar and pestle, which uses mechanical advantage, a chair, wheeled luggage. Wheeled luggage sounds so obvious, but if you're my age, you remember carrying your luggage everywhere. And then you remember when they invented wheeled luggage, it was four wheels. Anybody remember this? And you'd take a strap and you'd carry it around and it would follow you like a dog that you were trying to train. Right? Yes. So it also includes extremely complex systems. We have cars, airplanes, the electrical grid, wireless phones, network computers, offshore platforms. You know, some offshore platforms are almost as tall as the Empire State Building from the top to the bottom. Engineering also involves something that scientists don't usually have to deal with, which is trade-offs. How do you make it? How many functions do you put in? How complex? How durable? How easy to use? How expensive? Engineering also, I missed a slide here, but engineering also involves human and user factors. Is it easy to use? Is it easy to understand? Can we access it? Can we control it? One of the worst engineering disasters is when I was growing up is somebody built the motor for the Ford Pinto, and you couldn't change the spark plugs in the motor unless you pulled it out of the car. Obviously, they did not make that car the next year. So, as I was saying, engineering is different from science. It involves compromises. It involves issues of durability, cost, ease of use. Of course, you can't imagine a scientist saying, can I afford this theory? Or is this equation easy to use? No. That's because engineering and science ask very different types of questions. Scientists ask why. They look for patterns. They make connections. They explain things with general theories. What is the great thing that scientists want? They want a theory of everything, right? Engineers, entirely different. They take the general and they apply it to the specific. They want to know, how do I make something work? And very often you can start with the same general idea, like these two cars here, and end up with something extremely different, a sports car and a van. The trade-offs, these type of trade-offs often go back and forth with science. New discovery creates different types of trade-offs. For example, I don't know if any of you have relatives, perhaps, who have severe arthritis, and they live with arthritis pain. It used to be the doctors would say, you have to endure that pain as long as you can, because once we put an artificial hip in, if it fails, we may not be able to put a second one in, and they could never put a third one in. Things started to change. People have been looking for years and years for more durable types of materials, and about 5 years ago, they invented a new way of making a plastic they already knew, and with that, they were not only able to make hips that last longer, but they can make hips that were bigger. So in the past, for example, you couldn't go skiing if you had an artificial hip. Now they're big enough that you can do all kinds of sports activities that were impossible only a few years ago. Now what I'd like to do is tell you some stories about engineering, and we'll take three themes in which engineering differs from science: time, money, and user interface. So let's talk about time. Time is something that often involves trade-offs. Time is one of the trade-offs that we have, rather. Sometimes engineering change is very rapid. For example, the computer industry has been doubling the number of transistors on a chip since the 1970s, really, mid-70s. My first computer chip had about 32,000 transistors. If I were to go buy a chip today, I would get 500 million transistors every 2 years. Wheeled luggage is another thing that came along pretty fast. One day, I saw one in the airport. I came back to the airport about 6 months later, and everybody had one except me. Sometimes change takes a lot longer. I gave you some examples like fusion and fuel cells. Faxes. Faxes were around forever. Faxes were around in the 1950s. They cost $50,000. And then once people found ways to make them cheaper, they were everywhere. Now, why does change take so long? There are a number of reasons for this. Like scientific method. Engineering tends to use, you start with, that's basically, let me try that again. Scientific method, you start with a theory, you test it, revise it. Unlike science, though, instead of starting with a theory, you start with a final result. You know where you want to go. You test and you revise to achieve that result. Sometimes, along the way, it's like me using a map of San Jose, much can go wrong. I'll give you an example of unexpected problems that can crop up. Are many of you familiar with MEMS, microelectromechanical systems? These are tiny little semiconductor-sized devices, and they use very small moving parts. Oftentimes, those parts are either actuated by electricity or they produce electricity when they move. This is part of a MEMS accelerometer. You see all those long poles in there, the long rods? What will happen? You know when you drive a car, remember when the antennas were all on the outside of the car? What would happen is you would take off and the antenna would sort of tilt backwards a little way and you'd stop suddenly and it would whip forward. That's exactly how this works. And it measures the electrical field between, it produces a certain amount of current when it does that. And the amount of current is equivalent to the acceleration. Brilliant, brilliant type of development. So, what they wanted to do back about 15 years ago is replace the old ball in a tube that they used to use for setting off airbags in cars. Cars would decelerate, the ball would pop out of its holder, slide down to the end of the tube, and the bag would inflate. These things were big, they were expensive, you needed a lot of them, and they were slow. So MEMS were good. They were faster, cheaper, and simpler. So a number of companies were working on this, and one that I know, NovaSensor, was working in the lab. Perfect. Worked great every single time. So they said, great, we're going to be the first ones to sell this, and we're going to make a ton of money. So they went ahead, and they put it over in their factory, and they got them out, and every one of them failed. Every one of them. It took months to figure out why. And this is what makes engineering so much fun and so cool. Hang on a second. In the lab, it turns out that they didn't have great equipment. So the surfaces, see we have two flat surfaces there? Well, in the lab, the surface wasn't quite so flat. It was more like this, wavy a little bit. What was happening is in the production system, you get something that was a little bit wavy. And so it worked fine. When they made it very flat, now you know how static electricity works? Well, there's another force called van der Waals force, which is entirely unnoticeable in our physical universe, in the universe where things are big. But at the size of electronics, of small electronics, van der Waals force was enough that when these tiny little things would deform, they eventually developed a nice name for this. It was called stiction, a combination of sticky friction. They didn't solve the problem, and somebody else made all the money. Now, another thing that happened, for example, another thing that takes time is that a lot of times in today's world, we have to integrate complex systems. The most famous example of this that you probably remember was the Mars Climate Orbiter in 1999. This was a satellite that we sent to Mars that did its navigation once it got to Mars in English measurements, and then took the information and calculated in metrics. So you can guess what happened. But I've got an even better one. Here's one. This man decides he gets a very, very fancy car, Cadillac DeVille, Sedan DeVille, right? And it comes with an expensive, expensive radio. But, of course, time doesn't stand still. People upgrade all the time. He wants a satellite radio. So he takes his radio out, and he puts his new radio in, and all of a sudden, the air condition doesn't work, the alarm doesn't work, and the car diagnostics doesn't work. So they say, oh, well, we must have cut a wire. They go back in and they can't fix it. What this man is now doing in Boston is he is driving with two radios in his car. One radio he listens to in the front, and the second radio is in the back, and that allows him to operate his air conditioner in the summer. So Another thing that takes time is applying a generalized engineering solution to a specific application. So I'll give you an example. Now, you all know what anti-lock brakes are, right? You'll be driving, you'll hit your brakes, and if it's slippery or something, what would happen normally is you would hydroplane. Your brakes would stop, and you'd just skim right off the top of the water and hopefully not into something. And you're probably familiar with traction control. Those are similar to four-wheel drive cars where each wheel or axle gets separate power based on your needs. Well, electronic stability control builds on that, and what it does is it keeps your car from going into a skid. For example, a common situation would be you're driving along behind a truck, and something falls out the back of the truck. So you quickly pull out of the lane to get around it, and then you want to get back in the lane. Only a lot of times what happens, because you shouldn't be in that other lane and there's something coming up very quickly, you do it so fast that the momentum in the back of your car will turn your car like this as you try to go back, and all of a sudden you're skidding down the road. I've seen this happen to somebody else in a car near me. It is scary. What electronic stability control does is it brakes each wheel independently so that you will not skid out. An absolutely brilliant system. Now, how do you implement something like this? Well, there are 400 variables that you need to match to each car. Okay? So, first of all, you've got to be extremely reliable, right? You don't want to be going down the highway. You're doing 100 kilometers, right? Going down the highway. And all of a sudden, your car thinks that it's skidding and starts breaking wheels. No, that would be bad. Okay? The other thing you don't want to do is, let's say, you know, I'm an old guy. I like to drive a nice big car, you know, safe, okay? My son would like to drive a sports car with a stick. When he goes into a turn, sometimes he wants to do a little of that, right? Skid out a little bit into the turn. People who love sports cars love to drive them hard. You have to tune the general program to the behavior of the car and the user. And that's something that can take a lot of time with 400 variables. So it takes months and months of time. And what you're really doing is you're making it so idiot-proof that I can drive it and my son can drive it. Like I said, I had three themes. Time was one of them. Money is a second one. Now, you never hear a scientist say, that theory costs too much. Never hear that, right? But engineers, you hear it all the time because it has to be practical. Somebody has to pay for it. There's many ways to make things cheaper. For example, you can use thinner metals. You can use fewer screws. There's a very famous story about John Rockefeller. He was out in his oil fields. This is John Rockefeller who created Standard Oil about 100 years ago. He was out in his oil fields watching people put oil into barrels. And he asked, how many drops of solder do you use to put the top of the barrel on? And they said 40. So he said, well, try 38. So they did 38, and it leaked. So he said, okay, now try 39. And it didn't leak. So he said, from now on, we're going to use 39 drops of solder. Now, drop of solder, what does that mean? Well, at the time, he was probably doing several hundred thousand barrels of oil a day. He eventually went to millions of barrels a day. So we're talking close to a billion drops of solder every day. He probably saved hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars with that. Okay? What happens, though, if you want to replace something with something that's more expensive? Let's say you want to replace metal with plastic. Now, metal tends to cost a lot less than plastic. So how is this possible to do it? This is what they call systems engineering. Now, I had a lovely picture, but I think you've probably all seen metal fans, right? So how do you make a metal fan? Well, the first thing you got to do is get a big metal press, which is probably close to about that high here, very big. You take a thin piece of metal in, it comes down, and it cuts the metal and shapes it in one operation. Then you take that and you put it into some holders. Then you make the grill so that you can't put your finger in it, right? The grill consists of wire that you're going to bend, and then you're going to solder together. Lots of steps. How do you do this with plastic? Well, you create a mold, and molding machines are big, but not as big and not as expensive as metal stamping machines. You create a mold, you shoot the plastic in, and you come out with a blade with the holder, all as one piece. How do you make the grill? Same way. You get out one piece, it's got everything on it, there's no welding, there's no cutting, nothing. Not only that, it's got snaps on it. So when you're putting their fan together, instead of having somebody on the assembly line with a screwdriver screwing it in, you just put it, line it up, give it a smack, and it's in. Done. So what you've done is you've sold somebody something more expensive because they don't have to invest in expensive stamping, cutting, and welding equipment, and they can do the molding faster and get everything at once with fewer parts, and it takes less labor to assemble. This is, incidentally, how they are probably going to develop the first fuel cell application. Now, you've probably all seen stories about fuel cell cars and fuel cell buses. So you want to know what's going to be the first thing that actually makes money for somebody in a fuel cell that they can sell as far as a mobile application? It's going to be a forklift in warehouses. Now, why should that be? Well, I'll tell you. Many warehouses work 24/7, so they're open all day, all night, the really big ones, right? They have to use a battery inside or everybody would drop dead from carbon monoxide poisoning. So they are using a battery, and the battery will last for 8 hours. What happens at the end of 8 hours? You drive your fuel cell all the way to the other side of the warehouse, and over there they have stations with crews, and it takes them from 10 minutes to half an hour to swap the battery with another battery that's been recharging for 8 hours. Okay? So you take that, you bring it in, you bring it back, you take the old battery, start recharging that. So that means in order to run battery-powered forklifts, you've got to have multiple changing stations, because these warehouses will have 20, 40, 60 of these fuel trucks. You've got to have multiple changing stations. You've got to have crews. You've got to have lifting equipment, because the batteries weigh about a ton and a half each. And you've got to have space to recharge all the batteries. What happens with fuel cells? Fuel cells, first of all, run 12 hours at a time. So you only have to do something twice a day. Secondly, they take hydrogen fuel. This is like gassing up at a gas pump. You go over to the pump, you put it in your fuel tank, and you turn it on, and 5 minutes later you're done. You don't need the extra batteries, you don't need the extra space, you don't have to swap the battery out, you get rid of the crew, you could take the space and convert it into more storage. The problem with fuel cells, of course, is that no one knows how long they're going to really last. I was just over talking at a meeting of fuel cell people, and they were telling me things like, oh, we can get them to go 5,000 in the lab. Yeah, and then somebody else says, well, don't believe anything they say if they can't show it to you out in the field. So there's another case of taking something ridiculously expensive like a fuel cell and making an economic case for it based on the total system cost. So let's talk about one other thing. This is one of my favorite. Now, users. You know, there are lots of users for engineered products. They could be consumers. They could be operators. They could be technicians. Could be other machines. We talked a few moments ago about electronic stability control. The next generation of electronic stability control is going to warn you when you're about to crash into the back of another car. So how's it going to do this? Now, let's say, everybody look at me when I made that sound, or did you look in different places? If you use the sound, people tend to move their heads side to side. So what they said is, in order for people to really know that they're coming up on something first, we're going to break the car. So they give the car a few short breaks, because when you're moving forward and you suddenly start to stop, you look forward. If they used the sound, you might do this and not see what was coming up in front of you. Brilliant piece of interface work. Now, what's the best interface on the planet? The iPod, right? So here's something you didn't know, maybe. What was the technology breakthrough in the iPod? This is great. It was a tiny little hard drive, about the size of my thumbnail, right? Very thin, and it was a hard drive. And for the first, it wasn't the interface, wasn't the, you know, the click and scroll round gizmo, wasn't the screen, it was the hard drive, because it created a problem. You know, now, do you remember what I had a, this is the only picture I really need, but do you remember what MP3 players looked like? They would be about the size of my thumb. They'd have a screen on them that was somewhat smaller than my thumbnail. But it didn't really matter so much because you only could store 100, 200 songs, right? And you'd scroll down the list of the songs to get to the one you wanted. You know, if that is if you didn't have big clumsy fingers like mine and you could work the little gadgets over there. The problem with the iPod was you could score thousands of songs. So you needed a whole different way to, first of all, get the thousands of songs on there. And then you needed a different way to manage the songs once they were there. So, how do you get the songs on there? iTunes, right? They've created a very simple appliance-like approach to doing this. You can buy all your songs from Apple, put them right there. You can also burn all your CDs. So that they've created a system where they found, first of all, they find a way to get everything to your computer and then from your computer into the iPod, right? That's job number one. Number two, how do you store everything once it is there? So what they do is they create the little round, you know, that wonderful little scrolling device and the clicks, and it allows you to set and a screen big enough to see. But rather than make something really awful and ugly, they made it really cool. You know, it's thin, it's small. I mean, have you seen the Microsoft version of this? What do they call it, the Zune? It's like a box of cigarettes. It's the ugliest thing you've ever seen. No one's going to ever buy that, no matter how cool it is technologically. Because the design was so great because they had that very thin hard drive. And they said, we don't want to just make a device. We want to make a device that's cool. So they had a very simple, display. You could see maybe a dozen songs at a time. You could categorize your songs. Oh, look at that. Incidentally, Apple did this before. They did this with the Macintosh. I remember getting my hands on one of the first Macintoshes when it came out. Now, anybody remember DOS and PCs with DOS? Right. If you're a certain age, you remember this because if you wanted to do something, you had to write a command. You had to memorize all the commands, and then you had to write it down, and it would do. And it would take several, you know, to open a file. You know, you want to go into a folder like where I am and open a file. It would take like a dozen clicks before you could get to that, open it up, and get something out. But the PC, you know, the engineers had different users in mind. The Macintosh was very simple. They called it the computer for the rest of us. And what they meant by that is that it was simple to learn and use. You plugged it in, it worked reliably. So what was it about the PC that made it, that this is sort of what DOS looked like if you wanted to know what was in one of your folders. So what was it about the PC that made it so popular? I mean, you know, there's something like 9 PCs sold for every Macintosh. And the reason was it was incredibly flexible. You could turn it into anything. For example, you could put in new memory. You could put in graphics cards. You can put in sound. I had Macintoshes, and let me tell you, it was not cheap to do anything if you wanted to change it. And the PC was made to be changed. People take PCs. Even right from the beginning, they turned them into a cash register. They would turn them into a security system where you could look at all your cameras. There's a company called National Instruments that essentially turned them into a digital instrumentation for laboratories. Anybody who works in a lab's probably used it. So a lot of times it's the vision of the user that determines what something looks like. Just the way a sports car is built for my son. And, you know, a sedan is built for me.
A preguntas y respuestas. Por favor, sean breves.
Gracias. Oh, before you answer, let me do my conclusion. My conclusion is that science isn't going to solve problems by itself. It's going to take engineering. And what I really wanted to do today is give you some ideas of how engineers think and work so that when somebody says to you, you know, we have a new invention or I've discovered something interesting, you know how to ask the questions about the other side of the story.
Décima reunión de la Red Pop, mayo 2007, San José, Costa Rica.